Les grands rendez-vous diamants. Lors du deuxième grand rendez-vous diamant en janvier 2023, Robert Lepage s'est entretenu avec l'auteur de Quills, Doug Wright, au Moran Center, quelques jours avant la première de la pièce Quills. Dramaturge et auteur, Doug Wright a récemment présenté sa plus récente pièce, Goodnight Oscar, au Goodman Theater de Chicago, mettant en vedette Sean Hayes. Sa comédie musicale, War Paint, a aussi été à l'affiche sur Broadway. Son travail a rayonné dans plus de 30 pays à travers le monde. Détenteur de nombreux prix prestigieux, dont le prix Pulitzer pour sa pièce I Am My Own Wife, il a vu son œuvre Quills être adaptée à l'écran, de même que d'autres à venir, notamment The Burial avec Jamie Foxx et Tommy Lee Jones. Il a récemment scénarisé le film sur Peggy Lee, Fever, pour le réalisateur Todd Haynes, avec l'actrice Michelle Williams. Pendant 20 ans, il a mentoré des jeunes scénaristes à l'Institut Sundance. Il a enseigné ou donné des conférences à Yale, Princeton, Columbia, Juilliard et à l'Université de New York. Monsieur Wright vit à New York avec son mari, le compositeur-interprète David Clement, et leurs deux chats, Glynis et Murray. Notez que comme l'invité est américain, la discussion se déroule en anglais.
So, hi, Doug. How are you doing?
Good. Very good. Nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to see you again. Actually, the last time we met, I think, was in the spring of 2019.
I think that's correct.
Something like that. I was performing at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Mm-hmm. You came to see the show. We went for dinner. And we had this long conversation about musicals. Oh. of course, you know, you're a great playwright, but you also do musicals. You're a librettist, and I think we were discussing at that point that you were working on a project with Patti LuPone about Elizabeth Arden, I think?
Yes, a musical called War Paint, which was about the birth of the women's cosmetics industry and the rivalry that existed between Elizabeth Arden and Helena Rubinstein, who were two of the most powerful women in that field, mm-hmm. and two of the first true female industrialists in our country. And so that show opened before the pandemic and enjoyed a healthy run. And Patti LuPone was pretty legendary in it, I have to say.
Yeah, I can imagine.
She was fantastic. I'll tell one self-indulgent memory,
please,
if I
do.
May. And when I was a boy growing up in the cultural wasteland of Texas, I say that lovingly, I would lie on the den floor and listen to the old Evita album with Patti trilling away her various Andrew Lloyd Webber numbers, and I'd let her voice sort of course through my body. And then almost 50 years later, I was at the Nederlander Theater in New York, and I was exhausted from a very long technical rehearsal, and I went up to the balcony and lay on the floor. And below on the stage, Patti launched into her 11 o'clock number, and I felt her body, her voice course through my body again. And I thought, wow, this is just like being on the den floor back in Texas, only I'm in a Broadway theater and she's singing a song in a show that I wrote. And so it was a remarkable experience.
And you are actually doing something on Broadway that's opening in April, I think.
Yes, and it's a play called Goodnight Oscar, and it's about an American humorist who's largely been forgotten, a man named Oscar Levant. Does that name mean anything to any of you?
Well, he was on the Jack Parr show, was it?
He was a celebrated
guest. I'm revealing
guest.
My age by saying that.
Well, really more your parents' generation than your own,
yeah,
even.
Yeah, pretty much, but I remember.
Yeah, but it's interesting because I feel, in some sense, you said... I've been writing musicals, and I do feel like this new play, Goodnight Oscar, is on a continuum with Quills, if you will, mm-hmm. In as much as it's a play by me. There are no songs, so I have fewer people to blame if it goes badly. But it also is about a cultural provocateur who was talking outside of his own time, and both bringing enlightenment and wreaking havoc. And he did it on 1950s television. Sade obviously did it in 18th century France. But in a way, they're interesting bookends. And so Oscar Oscar was a pianist and a best friend to George Gershwin, but ultimately he became undone by an addiction to prescription medications. And so as his life waned, the only way he could earn a living was by being a wag on late night talk shows mm-hmm. because he no longer played piano. And there was one night that he was supposed to appear live on television, and his wife had just that morning committed him to a mental asylum, shades of Quills again, and the head of NBC so wanted him on television that he got the doctor officiating at the asylum to grant a four-hour pass, and Oscar was placed in the custody of the National Broadcasting Company for four fateful hours in 1958, mm-hmm. and after repeated shock therapies, went on national television. So this play chronicles those 4 hours. And like Quills, it uses that historical scenario as an opportunity for me to invent and riff on some of my own thematic concerns. It's not strictly biographical, mm-hmm. but you can see that even Quills, which is 25 years old now, the issues in it still obsess me and permeate my writing, and I find myself drawn to these characters who cast themselves outside the larger culture to cause trouble.
So you mentioned you were brought up in Texas. So what drew you to the theater or to writing theater?
I think a number of things. A moment ago, you mentioned the wonderful Robert Wilson, who mm-hmm. I'm proud to say is a fellow Texan. And I think that Texas...
But he was from Waco, right?
Yes, okay. That's correct.
And you were from?
I was from Dallas, which is about 90 minutes, okay. I think, to the west of Waco. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a state of extremes, and it also, as a young person growing up, particularly a gay young person, it gives you an enormous amount to react against, and it creates, I think, a really verdant fantasy life and dreams of escape to some degree. But in the same breath, I'd say that innate in the constitution of most Texans is a buoyant sense of humor. And when you find them most maddening, chances are they can usually make a joke at their own expense and garner your forgiveness as a result. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be, it's a state full of storytellers. So I think that being indoctrinated in the art of telling a good story, being encouraged to laugh at myself, combined with a kind of political urgency to leave the state so I could go about building my own life, I think all of those things together pushed me in a kind of theatrical direction.
But was it at college? Was it in high school? Where did you first perform or direct or write? Or what was your...
My parents were not native to Texas, and they were a little bit... eccentric in their own way, and my mother always found children's music terribly grating, and she didn't like to play it for us on the record player. So when we were quite young, she would put on Broadway cast albums. So the first things that we listened to...
No wonder you're gay.
Exactly.
Totally. When have gay children play musicals.
She only has herself to blame. So that's what I grew up listening to, and so the first play I wrote, I was in the fifth grade. Okay. I'm hoping, now that you've made such a brilliant production out of Quills, you'll consider this text. I was 11 years old. It's set in a British manor house. Uh-huh. It's called The Devil's Playground, and everyone dies in the end. And it's full of really brilliant stage directions. Uh-huh. They throw an elaborate wedding where cookies are served. So it's very much an 11-year-old's idea of what adulthood uh-huh. might feel like.
So then you went to New York. You studied at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it? And is that where you became more serious about your playwriting? Or
as someone yourself who has written and directed and acted all quite brilliantly, I think, like you, initially, the drive was to create theatrical events. Mm-hmm. However I could get my foot in that proverbial door. And I think early on I learned that to direct, you needed a producer and a venue and a good play. And to act, you needed an interesting role and an offer from a waiting director. But to write, you only needed to sit down and begin. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have to rely on the approval or permission of anyone else. And that made writing appeal to me in a pragmatic way. And the fact that the rejections were usually not in person, but polite, restrained letters you got in the mail. That was also preferable. Mm-hmm. And I think, to speak with slightly greater candor, I think I realized, and maybe it was growing up in Texas as something of an outsider myself, I had cultivated a lot of defenses, mm-hmm. and I knew how to sort of present in a way that was socially acceptable and charming in a sort of southern way when required, but that was more about concealment than it was self-revelation. And of course, actors have to, in the purest way, strip themselves and reveal their most vulnerable core. And I think I learned that I just didn't have that facility. It was too frightening a prospect, which is why I'm in awe of people who act and the people in your company, because that is a gift that I just place above all others and found I could not do.
But you do have to be a bit of an actor to write the way you write, in the sense that sometimes, you know, we have these very, very difficult texts. We have to learn, and we have to try to put in our mouths and all that. And very often, it's very literary. You know, you want to, you know, masticate and try to sculpt it and make it something to pretend that you're the one that's lifting it up off of the page. But in your case, it sounds like somebody really witty sitting somewhere and saying, I'd like to say that, and I would say that, and I would respond to that, and then I would whip this line, and then I'd do this and all that. And that's the thing that I think is so alive about the writing and the sense of dialogue of your plays. Well,
I love hearing you say that. And just because I realized I didn't have the acumen doesn't mean I lost the desire. I think when I am writing the first drafts of my play, it is the one indulgent mm-hmm. opportunity I have to play all the parts. Mm-hmm. No one would ever want to see it, but I seem to need to subject myself mm-hmm. to it. So I'm always calling my husband David to come upstairs and read a scene with me. So together we've originated the roles in almost all of my plays. And thankfully, no one has ever seen us do it.
So you did have a brush with television at one time. You've met Norman Lear. Norman Lear took you under his wing. You went to L.A.?
Yes. The great sort of inventor of the American sitcom, or certainly someone who refined it mm-hmm. To an enormous degree and used it to startling and effective political purposes as well, Norman Lear invited me to L.A. to work with him on a number of new shows. I have to confess that this was in the late 80s, early 90s, when the bulk of Norman's achievements were behind him. So he wasn't still as active a producer as he had been, and regrettably, most of our projects didn't move forward. But I will say it was 3 years of my life when I got to sort of sit at the knee of one of our sort of best pop cultural satirists, and certainly a man who brought unusually, I think, challenging and substantive fare to American television. And he recently turned 100, and we spoke.
Oh, right. He's still alive.
Yes, he's still alive. He's 100 years old, yeah. Still in relatively good health. And the last time we had lunch, he comes to New York on occasion, and we do get mm-hmm. together. And he said, so I've come up with a new sitcom idea, and it's age-appropriate. It's set in a nursing home, and the title is Guess Who Died? So he's
so,
still
so
boasts.
So for the people in the room who aren't, may not be familiar with who Norman Lear was, he's of course responsible for all these great sitcoms, Maude, All in the Family, all of the spin-offs.
The Jeffersons. He brought
Jeffersons.
African Americans to television. Mm-hmm. He brought liberals, rednecks, Latinx families. He really democratized TV in a remarkable way.
Was he responsible also for Golden Girls, or was he
around? No.
Because it did feel as if it's the same kind of...
Very much born of the same aesthetic, uh-huh. I think. And also, if any of you remember, some deeply subversive shows, too, like Mary Hartman, yeah, which was a send-up of sort of banal American consumerism, and a show called All That Glitters, where the power dynamic between the sexes mm-hmm. was reversed. So those were all syndicated shows mm-hmm. because they were provocative enough he couldn't get network support, mm-hmm. but he made them anyway. So mm-hmm. I often think of New York theater, at least, divided into the commercial theater in Midtown and the really exciting, subversive, outrageous work that happens below 14th Street in Manhattan mm-hmm. and in Brooklyn. And I think American pop culture has those levels too, and I think Norman sometimes bridged them in really surprising ways.
So you did have a television period in the sense that before you came back to New York, all the big Broadway hits and all that, there's a television Doug Wright. Right. So, what do you think you've taken from that experience in your writing or in your creative life? Because I was in LA once with a friend who got me tickets to see a taping of Frasier. Uh-huh. Okay, and I was really I thought it was such an amazing experience because they'd do a take, and after the take, they would all come back to the writers and before writers, and they'd have like a tie and they'd be dressed like a three-piece suit, and then one would be assigned to a Frasier and say, well, maybe you should say it this way or that, and they would be correcting on the set, and I thought it was so amazing, you know, and one of the strength of course American sitcoms, the writing is always so incredible and so. So what do you think that you've learned from that, or that you've...
It's a wonderful question.
Besides the money.
That was welcome for a while. Mm-hmm. But it's a great question, and one, to some degree, I still struggle with, because I do think that the very best plays contain, in some way, the writer's DNA, and there's nothing more powerful than a single authorial voice that produces a work. And it's why you know when you're at a David Mamet play, which feels different than a Sam Shepard play, which feels different from a Lillian Hellman play. And so the author's consistency of voice in a work is extravagantly important to me, and I love being responsible for every single word on the page. Now, that's a kind of really elevated vanity, if you will, and I recognize that. Television did make me less precious about the art of collaboration, and certainly when I began to work in musical theater, I found that really useful because you're working with a lyricist and with a composer to fulfill scenes and complete dramatic moments, and it's no longer simply your province anymore. Mm-hmm. And even now, with the rise in streaming series on television, where television is kind of in a whole new age, I've been working again in that medium on a few prospective projects. And so I'm on Zooms or in rooms with four or five other writers, and I'm able to find the process exhilarating and not threatening. I still think if I didn't have those plays, the ones I feel like are truly born of my voice, I wouldn't feel quite as much like a writer. Mm-hmm. I'm still old-fashioned enough to feel that when it says written by, it means you actually chose those words in that sequence. Mm-hmm. And that's so rarely true in other media.
But have you ever heard that joke? How many playwrights does it take to change a light bulb?
I'm terrified. What?
Zero, because there will be no changes. So you do get complete control of your...
Yes, exactly.
All right. So, of course, then, because we're trying to jump to the, you know, the big mm-hmm. moments, the highlights of what you've accomplished, and of course, Quills is one of the most important ones at the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's really what kind of gives you notoriety, all these prizes come along and all that. Can you explain to us the context in which you've written Quills? Because, of course, it's a kind of a response to the zeitgeist of that.
Certainly, and also, I will just take the opportunity, since we're discussing Quills, to say that I've had the great pleasure of seeing Robert's production and his performance, and it's a play that is now 25 years old and that I've had the great privilege of seeing in a variety of venues. And this production, it's just spectacular. And
give him $20 to see.
No. And of course, I mean, you're very lucky. You're in Quebec City, and he's an artist in your own backyard. But of course, he's also an artist of international renown. And as someone in New York, alert to cultural affairs, I had seen Robert's work at BAM, and I had experienced his artistry. And so when he told me he was going to tackle the play, I was deeply excited. And if you haven't seen it yet, know that a very happy playwright is hovering somewhere in the theater, because that's not always the case. But in this case, it's emphatically so. Quills came about for a variety of reasons. I sometimes think when the overtly political or social meets the intensely personal, sometimes art results. And in this instance, there was a very public debate going on in the country about the nature of art and censorship. And the proponents of the debate at the time sort of found their apotheosis in the figures of, on the one hand, a conservative senator in the United States named Jesse Helms, and a radical photographer named Robert Mapplethorpe. And in all of these arguments over what art was worthy of presentation and worthy of government funding and worthy of cultural sanction, these two men were always cast as adversaries. Helms saying, "Deny that photographer funding," and the estate of the photographer saying, "We have a right to exist and to be exhibited." And so they were always talked about as adversarial. And I actually thought they were somewhat symbiotic, because the louder Jesse Helms declared that these photographs were immoral, the more campaign money he raised and the more voter support he got from his conservative base, and the more that Robert Mapplethorpe screamed about being the victim of censors, the more acclaim he got, till finally he had beautiful, fully published catalogs of his work available at Barnes and Noble, which was a level of success he previously never had. So I thought that there's a curious dance between the censor and the artist, and I came to think that maybe the censor, in the end, is the artist's most reliable muse. And so I wanted to write a play that addressed that notion. At the same time that I was thinking about all these lofty things, I was ending a love relationship with a very dear friend who also worked as a psychiatrist. So you had
worst kind of boyfriend.
Well, you had a psychiatrist and a writer having philosophical pillow talk. And in the play, when you see it, there's a sort of progressive young priest and a champion of mental health, aka a psychiatrist, okay, and a sort of unruly writer, mm-hmm, engaged in a lot of philosophical pillow talk, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so for the last Christmas we were together, he gave me Maurice Levay's absolutely seismic biography of de Sade. Okay. And I should have sensed that augured the end of the relationship. But I did read the book, and I found that it really spoke to this notion of censor and muse, uh-huh, in a way that was useful. And it also allowed me, if you'll indulge me, to write what was essentially a broken heart play or a breakup play. And so those two things came together in the piece.
Yeah, they're always the best, aren't they? they're hell to go through, but they're always the best.
It's true.
The thing that struck me when I first read, well, of course, I'd seen the film before I'd read the I read the play and all that, and when Jean-Pierre Cloutier offered that maybe we could do a production of it, that he would do the very first French translation, mm-hmm. which is kind of strange because you think the French would jump on something about Marquis de Sade, but actually they're very, very, they know they're sad, first of all, so they're very kind of prudent what they do with that. So anyways, we got very excited, and when the first time I read the actual play, I was struck. I thought, okay, if I agree to do this, to do the part of Marquis de Sade, I'm entering a very, very kind of dark zone. Do I really want to put myself for a couple of years in this really kind of weird, sadistic or masochistic attitude? So it was a very, very, very scary mm-hmm. process. But what was great about it, I was reading it, and it's you hang on to the wit. Mm-hmm. And you discover how, and of course it's your wit, but it's also the wit of the Marquis. He also was an incredibly witty person, very sunny in a certain way, very funny, great debates, great political debates. So you can hang on to all these other things, so you don't sink into the darkness, because there has to be darkness. There has to be. You have to indulge into that, and of course that's all there. And that's what I found so, and I never read or seen anything about the Marquis de Sade that was so colorful and not light, because mm-hmm, it is not mm-hmm. light, but so rich and subtle and full of contrast so I thought it was brilliant. So that is really what I guess, and I'm sure other actors who've got to perform the character kind of hang on to the same thing. You just kind of, you're going to this really, really tricky thing, and of course the play asks you to do stuff on stage that you've mm-hmm. never done. You're performing two-thirds of a play naked, and for a reprise after 2 years of pandemic, rehearsing naked in a set made of mirrors. It asks you to go to a place you've never been and do things you've never done, but of course you're guided by this extraordinary thing where, as a ham actor, you still want to have that mm-hmm. that laugh, because it's these great punchlines and it's these great things that you want to deliver and you want to. This was in Washington, right? Before it went to New York?
In truth, it was the reverse. The play opened in New York at the New York Theater Workshop in 1995, and it was directed by a man named Howard Schalwitz, who was the artistic director of a theater in Washington, D.C. called the Woolly Mammoth. So he directed it first in New York and then brought it to his own theater. But so it's associated with the Woolly Mammoth Theater because that was Howard's home, but it actually premiered in New York.
And was it instant success? Was the reaction, was it controversy? Was it?
I rather wish there had been more controversy, mm-hmm. but it was a surprising success. I had written the play while I was on a fellowship and was having a terrible case of writer's block. And so, stimulated by all these ideas I mentioned before, I put aside the play I was meant to work on and started to create this one instead. And when it was done, I thought it was just too filthy and outrageous to show to anybody. Mm-hmm. And a friend actually gave it to Jim Nicola of the New York Theater Workshop, who committed to do it. And so I was titillated and terrified by what the response might be. But it was very warm for a willfully provocative play. Mm-hmm. There was some, I remember, there was one instance where I was at the theater, I was standing in the back, and I was watching the play, and this woman finally decided she'd had enough, and she was in about the third row, and she got up and she kind of flounced out and headed toward the back of the stage, and then her husband got up and followed her. And before they could exit the theater, they heard another line that caught their attention again. So they decided to sort of linger mid-theater. Mm-hmm. And then a few lines later, they were outraged again. And they started again for the rear of the theater, but before they could get there, their interest was snagged once more. And they wound up watching the entire play from the rear of the theater, poised to leave. And I thought, that's kind of how I want everyone to watch this play. And then when it was over, they actually went back to their seats to participate in the ovation. I thought if that could be the experience of everyone seeing this play, if it could be that active in your heart that you don't know whether to stay or flee. I thought that was exhilarating.
Well, actually, just an anecdote. When we produced the play here at Le Trident, on the first preview, about halfway in the story, the Marquis gets his hands and feet cut off. And another member south of the equator. So, of course, we do it on stage, but we don't do it in a hyper-realistic way. Mm-hmm. We do it, it's kind of an evocation, you know? It's a kind of, so we do this kind of thing and all that. And then I get my first hand cut, and then somebody picks up this false hand and all that. Mm-hmm. And then we hear, in the room, and this woman, Pierre, stay with me, Pierre. And then we're kind of, what's going on? And I'm naked, and everybody's on stage with all this bloody stuff. You know, and then they have to bring an ambulance in, and this whole thing, and all that. And this guy just kind of went, and his wife was just screaming, all that. And my sister was in the back of the room, and because her son was a stage manager, and she was saying, open the lights, all that. And this was the first preview of the show.
Oh, my God.
And we went, we're in for big trouble here. I have to say, we were lucky, because after that, we performed it quite a lot. We played after in Quebec City, played in Montreal, in Paris, and Lyon, and all that. And so, I don't know, maybe, let's say we played close to 80 or 100 performances, and that never happened again. Mm. But this was quite a weird omen of that. But then you get, as an actor and as a director, you become conscious of what is it that you're doing on stage, and the power or the absence of an image, of a way of showing, or I don't know how to say in French, évocation, or to do to evoke. Is that an English word?
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, not too bad. to kind of, and what it triggers and all that. And you go, okay, so are we, you know, is this a good choice? Are we doing this right? And you get an idea of how it's eventually, because it's a funny play. You get laughs and you get all of that, but it gets really serious at one point. You go, are they still in the room with us? Are they still with us and all that? And then so that's kind of... So
there is... I will just... pardon me for interrupting, but I will just say that there are moments of real brutality in the play. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I deeply love about Robert's production is he realizes those in overtly poetic ways. So they have the full metaphoric weight of the violence. They have the kind of abject terror of the violence, but they also don't upstage the thematic content of the piece, if you will. They serve the moment in highly metaphoric ways that retain its power, but they are not literal acts of violence, which is one of the production's triumphs, I think.
So just a little aparte, I'd be curious about, considering the context in which Quills was written, besides the love loss and all that, this whole political thing going on in Mapplethorpe was a photographer, so you were in the visual arts. And at that time, there was also Andrés Cyrano's Piss Christ that provoked another thing with the Virgin Mary also. Mm-hmm. So anyways, it was a series of visual artists, mainly, who were doing this very provocative work on the verge of pornography. It was difficult to tell what was pornographic, what was political. So it was an interesting time, early 90s, I guess. So what's your relationship with visual arts? I'm curious because you also wrote a play, I think it was before Quills, Interrogating the Nude, with all these conversations with Man Ray and Marcel Duchamp about nude descending disc. So are you savvy of the visual arts, or are you? Is it something you wanted to do instead of writing, or is it because you think it's a good vehicle for the metaphors you entertain?
I don't know that I'm savvy or especially sophisticated about it, but I did, as an undergraduate, major in art history. It sort of seemed like the history of the world with pictures, and that was very appealing. But I think my parents were always taking us to the museum as a kid, and this is perhaps a terrible thing to say, but I'll never forget seeing Goya's painting of Saturn devouring his sons, if you know that painting from the Prado. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing that at 11 or 12 and viscerally feeling like it explicated certain aspects of my childhood. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean I had a very colorful larger than life and highly theatrical father who was sometimes quite overwhelming, and it was difficult to carve out my own space when he was in the room because he was somewhat all-consuming. And I remember seeing that image and walking away with it feeling like I had, the painting had seen me more fully than I'd seen it. And it's, so I guess my first true catharsis, maybe, that thing that we strive to induce in the theater, happened before a painting and felt like a theatrical event. And so I have always returned again and again to visual artist. It's also more exciting, I guess, to watch an actor paint than write. So I've written about more painters than I have fellow authors, for the most part.
Something I realized when we first performed Quills in Lyon, in France, we had a weekend off or something like that, and so we took a train and went to Paris because there happened to be an exhibition about Sade, Marquis de Sade, at the Musée d'Orsay. It was a huge exhibition, and I was so sad. And then you see the place Sade has in French culture. You know, it's not just one of them. It's how important and how seminal, no puns intended, Sade was for literature, painting, even music. And so what was interesting about that exhibition, because it showed works from the 19th century mainly, and all the romantics, and how romanticism, the romantic movement, came from Sade. Sade wasn't a romantic, but he gave way to romanticism. And you try to find why, what's the connection, and why do they all look at Sade as a great liberator of art and all that. And Victor Hugo has this interesting text about that, and he says that Sade brought things back to the primitive, to the basis, and that's what the real movement of romanticism, whether it's the German romantics or the French romantics, mm-hmm. is the Sturm und Drang thing of, you know, man, his, you know, the great, not God inspiring, but the storms and the great primal urges, and how that's what romanticism is kind of based mm-hmm. on, these kind of primal things, and how man is in control of his environment and all that. So all the great romantics, at least in France, connected with Sade on that. Thought that Sade kind of opened the door to this idea, and how they wouldn't have been Delacroix. That's what was strange to see in this exhibition, to see paintings by Delacroix and all these. What? And so Delacroix, Hugo, even Chopin. I mean, a lot of these great romantics probably wouldn't have been allowed to mm-hmm. do what they were doing, or wouldn't have been understood if Sade hadn't first plowed through that. Let's say these resistance that they mm-hmm. were under the Napoleon.
That's compelling.
So we know that Quills is a great play and it's performing on 28th until the 28th, and there's still some tickets left. But it also became a movie, and that's where I first saw it. A very different thing. Of course, mm-hmm. the soul is still there, the story, the structure is still there. So I'm very curious, because it is an interesting subject matter, how a writer adapts his own play into a film script. Does it reveal the power of theater versus the power of film? Were you burdened by realism that always comes, you know, because film always comes with a type of realism, whatever, but you have more freedom and more poetic freedom on the stage. So if you want to tell us a bit about the adaptation. And you've done some other adaptations and some screenplays besides that.
I'll start by saying this. I'm often asked which medium I prefer in the most basic way, and I'm fond of saying this, and that's when an audience comes into the theater and they sit down and the screen flickers to life and they've got their tub of popcorn and their Diet Coke and they're sitting back to watch, and you see Poland, 1938. Everyone in the audience sort of says, prove it. I want to see Polish architecture. I want to hear Polish accents. I want to see cars common to Poland in 1938. And if the film fails in its verisimilitude, it takes forever to earn that audience back. And you go into a darkened theater with 500 other people, and a curtain rises on a blank stage, and a lone actor walks across with a sign that says Poland, 1938, and 500 people in the dark go, okay, it's Poland, it's 1938, what's gonna happen next? And my answer is always, which audience would you rather write for? The one that says, prove it, or the one that says, fantastic, tell me the story. And so that's my answer there. Mm-hmm. As far as adapting Quills as a movie, the play is actually much more violent than the film, and in its own way, much more graphic. And that's in part what I was saying before about the metaphorical nature of the violence in the play and the way that Robert renders it. On screen, when you're obligated to a certain kind of realism, it was very easy for the film to descend into the kind of bloodbath that Sade himself might have adored, but that would have really got audiences to flee the theater, and that felt unproductive. So we had to scale back certain violent sequences in the film, and film always invites, the close-up. And I remember one remarkable morning when the actress, Kate Winslet, called me into her trailer, and she said, look, Doug, at this moment in the scene, you've given me a lovely set of lines, but if you'll just trust me, I think I can do that with my face. Philip Kaufman, the director, is going to give me a close-up, so let me try a couple takes without saying the lines. I think I'll still deliver the behavioral moment that you're seeking. And of course, she did. She's a brilliant actress. And so I did find that in a play that is dense with language and ideology, the ideology that's expressed verbally in the play had to be expressed through action in the screenplay, because oftentimes extended dialogue scenes curdle on film. So I was cutting line after line after line, and I would just get bereft, all my beautiful, beautiful writing on the floor. Yeah. And there's one wonderful moment in the piece where Sade has been deprived all of his writing implements and his paper, but he's desperate to write, so he bleeds his fingers and he writes on his clothing, which is his only recourse to keep writing. And so there's a scene in both the play and in the film where Sade appears in a suit covered in his own script. And so the costume designer of the film came up to me and said, I know it's been devastating for you to cut some of your very, very favorite lines from the screenplay. Trust me, we'll get them in the movie. And sure enough, in the film, Jeffrey Rush's suit covered in script. Those are all my favorite lines I had to cut.
That's brilliant.
So they are very different mediums, and you have to. Yeah. And it's no secret that at least in the States, theater is still to some degree thought of as being a hospitable writer's medium, and film is really regarded as an auteur's medium or a director's medium, emphatically. And so I was guided very strongly by the hand of Philip Kaufman in my adaptation. But I also was allowed to participate in the making of the film in the way that a lot of screenwriters aren't.
But isn't it, for example, the play has something very classical, which is unité de lieu. I'm looking for the English. Unité de lieu means it all happens in one place, right? Mm-hmm. That's one of the strengths of the play. So, of course, it's in different rooms and all that, but it's all in one big institute, mental institution and all that. So that's unité de lieu. It's a very classical, very strong way to, and very practical way to do it if you you take care of the set and all these things. But of course, in film, they want you to go and see Napoleon and wherever he is, and then you want to be in the, we talk about the revolution, and then suddenly you're at the scaffold, and so it kind of breaks open, and the movie loses a bit of its
pressure cooker.
Which makes it work so well, and recently, have you seen The Whale?
Yes.
was that a yes, yes of admiration or yes,
well,
yes
Sam Hunter, the playwright, full disclosure, is a dear friend.
Oh.
But I hear...
So don't report what I'm going to say.
No. Yeah, I hear diverse responses.
Because that's the case of, for me, of not, I wouldn't say a bad adaptation, but not a complete adaptation.
Yeah.
So it's all happens in one room.
Yeah.
Basically, it goes on the balcony at one point and comes back in. And you feel, after 10 minutes, you feel you're in a play that's been filmed. And
very much so.
So that's always... It's always
no, I don't disagree. And I'm still trying to calibrate that, because even as we talk about it, I'm currently working on the screenplay for Goodnight Oscar, which has yet to open on Broadway, and this has suddenly become accelerated. And I keep asking myself, the whole play is set at NBC Studios in Burbank in 1958, with Oscar getting out of the car from the mental asylum and going into the Tonight Show. And so I keep asking myself, do I want to open it up in any way, or are all the various locales within NBC Studios adequate? Because there is something in the theater I feel like I've been able to establish there's almost a palpable tension and things are about to explode because the stakes have gotten higher and higher and higher, and you're in an enclosed space that almost can't contain all the excitement. And I have yet to really learn how to do that on film, and that may just be an aspect of the... Certainly some films achieve that, but I haven't learned how to do it yet.
So I'm just trying to step ahead because there's so much... It's such an amazing career, and you have little time.
Stop.
It's just that, of course, we have to talk a bit about I Am My Own Wife, which is, of course, Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award also. So it's an amazing play. It's been remounted many times around the world, and it was done in Montreal, I think, about 5 years ago, something like that. It's an amazing play. So the Wall of Berlin falls. Somebody you know... tells you, I bumped into this person who's resisted all of the two fascist regimes, the Nazis and then the Soviets, and he is his own wife in the sense that he's actually a trans person, what we would call today a trans person,
but it wasn't
called that way at that time, and you get to meet this person, right?
Yes, I was so compelled, and thank you for pointing out that the nomenclature has changed since I wrote the play, and the trans community now has a specific set of preferred terms. So when I speak about Charlotta, I'm speaking about Charlotta circa 1993, and I often fall back into the terms that she used. So please forgive me. It's something I'm... we're all learning in this cultural moment, and I'm learning along with everybody else, but... Charlotta, who was born a biological male but identified as female and wore a dress and pearls and lived most of her life in this persona, was able to circumvent both the Nazis and the communist Stasi in East Germany, where she kept a small antique store. And I was fascinated by her story and the fact that she survived these two regimes, leading what at the time certainly was considered a highly original and daring life. And so I went to Berlin over a period of about 3 years and interviewed her extensively and amassed about 500 pages of transcribed interviews and wound up using those as the basis for my play. So it was documentary theater, if you will, and that it was composed of all these interviews, and yet I did take the usual liberties of the dramatist to create narrative continuity and clarify plot points and things like that. But it wasn't like Quills, where I thought the Marquis was established enough that I could take certain liberties, and there were a million biographies that would correct the record, and other writers had employed him to metaphorical uses before, like in Marat Sade, which is not strictly a biographical play about Sade, or Mishima's Madame de Sade. Sade has been used as a symbol a lot. So I felt like I could do that in Quills. But nobody knew about Charlotta von Malsdorf in I Am My Own Wife, so I really had to stick to the facts in telling that story.
It ended up being a one-man show, right? For one actor only.
Yes. Okay.
So I have a tricky question for you, because here in Quebec, in the past few years, we're very, very Quebec and the province, not the city, but in the nation, we're preoccupied by this thing of diversity, right? We're all, and the theater is a tricky thing because in principle we should be, theater acting is about putting yourself in the skin of somebody else to better understand the other person and convey whatever emotions or ideas. So it's a tricky thing. So of course in the last few years there's been all sorts of controversies. And with time we've started inviting people from diverse communities to be seen, to be visible in the theaters. And at the same time, we've been forbidding people from performing certain, they said, well, you know, you shouldn't, this belongs to this people, you shouldn't be. So where I'm getting at is that today, this play, I Am My Own Wife, can it be performed by somebody else than a trans person?
That is such a good question, and a question that is on my conscience a lot, because the play has actually been shut down because a trans person was not cast, excuse me, in the role of Charlotta.
Okay.
When I wrote the play, I worked in collaboration with a wonderful director, Moises Kaufman, who also wrote a beautiful play called The Laramie Project, and with a brilliant actor named Jefferson Mays. Now, as it happened, Moises and I were both gay men, and our actor, Jefferson, was a straight man. And Moises and I used to tease him endlessly, saying, here we are working on this wildly gay play, and the straight man in the room is the one wearing the dress. And so that was the object of a great deal of mirth. That was in 2003. More recently, in a way that really moves me, the trans community has adopted the play, and it is taught now more often in gender studies classes even than in theater classes in universities in the States. And I'm deeply moved by that, and I'm deeply touched that that community has embraced it. I was recently asked to write a preface to the play insisting that only trans people perform it. And I was unable to do that. And so the closest I could come was to say, I feel that any theater preparing to do this play should reach out to and have meaningful conversations with its local trans community, especially the artists in that community, as they move forward. But I do know that this notion of, I want to say this delicately because it's such an inflammatory and dangerous topic.
I know.
Yes. the notion that if you have lived something, you can better represent it isn't always a true one. And by that, I mean sometimes we look for very safe constructs that we can pour our souls into and reveal ourselves in unexpected ways. And I guess, if you'll let me tell a brief anecdote, there's a wonderful screenwriter named Paul Schrader. Paul Schrader, you may know, wrote famously the movie Taxi Driver. Brilliant man. And he was telling me that he was working with a young student in a screenwriting class. And this student was having an awkward time in college because he'd come out as a gay man on campus, but in his small southern community back home, he was still pretending to be straight for fear his parents would reject him. So he started to write a soul-bearing screenplay about what it was like to be an out, proactive, politicized gay man on his college campus and a closeted, would-be straight man at home with his family. And Paul said, it was the most indulgent, navel-gazing, oppressive, uninteresting screenplay you can imagine. So Paul said, I did something that I very rarely do, and I gave him an assignment. And I told him to write the story of a double agent in World War II who's serving the Germans and serving the British. Because that young man could go to the library, could talk to veterans, could do all of the requisite research to learn what he needed to learn about the historical trappings of that story, and the great gift of that story, he already knew what was at its core, which was the cost of living a double life. So, with adequate disguise that protected his quivering pink underbelly, he was actually able to write a galvanizing, interesting, and pulse-quickening screenplay. So the way that we as artists appropriate subjects to tell our stories, you can never know what is personal and public in those tales. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we have to reach for those things that protect us so we can make ourselves more vulnerable than you might ever suspect. And that's why one of the premier novels that drew back the veil on an ancient cultural tradition that was not his own was Arthur Golden's Memoirs of a Geisha. So if a straight Southern American white man could write such a penetrating, moving, and emotionally true story of a Japanese geisha, isn't that the gift that art promises? And doesn't it promise that somehow at the end of this struggle we can find commonality? So I believe all of that. I also want to say the flip side of that is in an industry, and I'm speaking of theater in the States, I have no proficiency of theater in Canada, but in the theater in the States, as in so many institutions, there is a kind of calcified, almost oblivious racism that has persisted for generations. And now certain communities are crying out for employment and inclusion. And if the theater is going to grow and stay relevant and flourish, we need those people, and we need to shed a lot of our blinders and bring them into the fold in as vigorous and as inclusive a way as we possibly can. But I think there is a marked difference between who we embrace in our profession, and that should be everyone, versus when and how we dictate what writers can and cannot broach. And when they do broach subjects outside their experience, hold their feet to the fire, hold my feet to the fire, and demand accurate representation, or at least integrity. I condone that entirely, but I don't think we should get into the iffy business of telling painters who they can paint.
Of course, the subject matter that could go on and on and on and on.
I know, I could talk about that forever.
Okay, my last question. Okay, we just came out of this pandemic, right? It's been a very tough time for the theater people because we didn't get even to perform and all that. In Shakespeare's time, of course, there was the plague and there was all of that, and Shakespeare wrote King Lear during the plague, took advantage of the plague to write King Lear. So did you write your King Lear during these 2 days, two years of a pandemic, or any big masterpiece that you took advantage of? Or did the pandemic inspire you?
Well, I had to go about the grisly process of earning a living. So I spent almost a year and a half doing a commissioned script for a remake of the John Updike novel, The Witches of Eastwick. Okay. And right before the pandemic ended, Warner Brothers fired me. So I'm not sure I'd call that my Lear.
Okay, so we'll have to wait and see. All right. Okay, so this is about the time where we want to turn towards the audience and take some questions. Yes, we have a question here. Gentleman in the front.
In the writing of Quills, at one time did the title come to you? And in the writing itself, did it win a rapid flow? Or is it something that at the end you had to correct and correct and correct? You
know? Oh, thank you for that question.
It's the writing process.
I knew I wanted to write about Sod and all these issues that I was describing, And I remember that I came across a paragraph in LaVey's biography where it said that the Marquis kidnapped his sister-in-law, ruined her for marriage, abandoned her in a convent, and then went to see the Pope. And I thought, well, that's pretty good. And I was going to dramatize that. And so the first draft was a conversation between de Sade and the Pope. And it was discursive, and it was a debate. It wasn't a play. So I went back to the biography, and I kept reading. And I read that at one point during his incarceration at Charenton, the priests took his quills away in order to prevent his scabrous prose. And I thought, that's a dramatic event. When a volatile imagination is denied the one means of expression it has to exorcise itself, that's a drama. And so it was in that moment that I thought of quills as the title of the play. And in truth, in ways that they rarely do, this play did unspool very quickly. And so the first draft was written in a sort of mad rush of frenzied inspiration. And then the redrafting happened over a period of about 3 years. But the initial draft came quickly.
Another question? Oui, Sophie.
Bonjour, Monsieur Doug Wright. I will speak in French. Cet après-midi, on parlait de quills. Et tout d'un coup, un de mes camarades me dit, tu sais que dans cette pièce, il n'y a pas un mot écrit par le Marquis de Sade. Alors moi, je croyais que quand même, dans la pièce, lorsqu'il se raconte sur ses vêtements, dans sa cellule, tout, il y avait des... Alors je me suis demandé, d'abord, est-ce que c'est bien vrai qu'il n'y a pas un écrit de Sade? Et si c'est le cas, est-ce que c'est parce qu'il n'est pas assez bon? Vous êtes meilleur?
All right, so I'll translate for you. So actually, somebody just mentioned to her that in the play, there's actually not a single word written by Sade, that it's all pure invention on your part. And the question is, she's asking, is it because he's not as good a writer as you are?
Well, truthfully, I didn't want to simply paraphrase Sade. And so I don't know if any of you have read 120 Days of Sodom, and I'm not necessarily recommending that you do, but in it, Sade describes 120 days and 120 atrocities that a group of libertines can commit upon their captives. And even Sade, by about day 93, ran out of energy. So, like, days 94 to 120 are sort of fragments of stories he never completed. So I took my inspiration from those fragments and did my best to finish them in his spirit.
Another question? Une autre question?
Yes.
Somebody... Yes. There in the back.
I have one here. Doug, I felt as though you skated a little bit around the issue of who's entitled to portray what parts in what plays. Would you be prepared to go on the record and agree that anybody should be allowed to portray any part and then just observe what... opinions might be expressed about the validity or otherwise of the portrayal?
I love your challenge, and I would say yes when we have achieved a more diverse and inclusive workforce. And I say that I think we're going through a period of growth and change right now, and what people really want is equity of employment. And I think I'm working on a piece now, and it's a challenging piece, because it's about a man who goes around the world. Now, it's the theater, you have limited resources. We have one lead actor, we have a company of 5 actors that is going to play every other ethnicity in the piece. Now, in the current climate, that is a recipe for disaster. But what we want to do is sort of get really reckless with the conceit that anyone can play any role, and we want, you know, a Latinx actress playing the German language teacher, and an African American man playing the Japanese kaiseki master. And we want to completely play with that palette, if you will, and give everybody the chance to play every role. And I think that is the ideal we need to reach, and to do it, we just need to open our arms a little wider to our compatriots in the field who've been systematically denied opportunity.
Another question. And are there other questions? Alava. Please do.
Good day, Mr. Wright. And I should let you know I am a journalist with the local English newspaper, the Quebec Chronicle Telegraph, and Robert used to deliver our newspapers one time in his life. You are a unilingual Anglophone, or do you speak French? Did you write the play in English and have someone translate it to French? Is it being performed in English?
No, it's performed in French.
Performed in French.
Yeah, and it's Jean-Pierre Cloutier, who is an actor, who about in the 2015, I think it was, when we eventually got the rights and all that, was the first to translate it in the French language. But before that, it had never been translated in French.
Okay, thank you.
And I am not... Ashamedly, I am not conversant in French, and I had to rely on the Richard Seaver translations of Sade in doing all of my own research. I did learn German for Charlotta von Malsdorf, but she was living and Sade was dead, so I figured I was safe.
An interesting question, though, a follow-up question to this is that you deliberately decided to write it in a Jacobean English? There's a period, specific, because when we do it in French, we have the privilege of doing it with what we Quebecois try to do, what we call a French accent when we're able to do it. But we have this kind of universal French that we use, but that's as faithful as it can to the period. But in your case, to kind of give an impression of that? You chose Jacobean?
Sade, oftentimes French literary theorists wanted to lump him in with the Gothic writers, in part because he was a huge fan of Matthew Lewis and Anne Radcliffe. But he always said he wasn't truly a Gothic writer because he didn't use supernatural elements in his stories, and that's what prevented him from being a Gothic writer. But his kind of overwrought, incendiary, self-conscious prose suggested to me an almost kind of Gothic tone. Mm-hmm. And that could have in part been the Richard Seaver translations that I was relying on, but I also felt it's that inflated, self-conscious grandiosity that actually makes the novels bearable to read, because otherwise they really are just catalogs of atrocities, and there is a kind of exuberance in the language that doesn't absolve them of their sins, but makes it resonant as satire and not just unrelenting grimness. Mm-hmm.
There's a question.
Hi. I'd like to ask a question, Doug. I'm going to the play in a couple of days. I'm looking forward to it very much. But I have to admit, I didn't know very much about it. And I would like you to talk a bit more about the metaphorical side of it, because I asked somebody to the play, I gave them a ticket as a birthday present, and I'm just learning now that it's Robert on the stage naked and lots of bits of cut off limbs and blood, and I'm wondering if you can explain to me how I can explain to my guest the
is your guest 16 years old or older?
No, but not that much older actually. Okay.
Well, the play ain't
so
for
the
sissies.
Metaphorical side of things.
I mean, we've talked a lot about Sade the satirist and even Sade's wit. Make no mistake, he is still the author of the most toxic prose that Western culture has ever created. And one reason he's an interesting subject for examination is because he's a study in such extremes. There's you'll read endless passages of adolescent pornography combined with the ugliest pathologies, and then there'll be a hilarious satirical riff on a chapter in the Bible that's worthy of Jonathan Swift. So he's maddening that way. And so there is, in writing about him, you have to take him all at once or not at all. And by that I mean, I hope the play lets you see why the Surrealist called him the freest spirit that has ever lived. And Roger Shattuck said that to publish him is in and of itself a sin. And that feminists like Andrea Dworkin have said that he is the first true feminist because he allows women the privilege of sexual misbehavior as well as men, to people like Susie Bright, who say that he is the father of the very worst kinds of pornography in our culture. So he was all of those things, right? And so a stiff drink for your friend, maybe?
No, this is already excellent. I just memorized.
Sorry, we didn't get the first part of your...
This is excellent. I'm just memorizing exactly what you said, and she's going to be thrilled.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. And, of course, a big thank you to our guest, Doug Wright, who has had the courage to come up to freezing Quebec City, all the way up from sunny New York.
Oh, right.
Clean aired and sunny New York. I hope your time in Quebec will be fun, that you won't be disappointed with the remount on Wednesday. And we're happy to have you here. And I know you like the city. Come back in the summer, please, because it only comes in the winter when it's minus 35. So Quebec City is a great town for
very much
a lot more. So thank you. Thank you very much. Very honored. Merci beaucoup. Merci tout le monde.
Si vous avez aimé l'épisode, n'hésitez pas à lui donner une évaluation positive. À bientôt pour un prochain Grand Rendez-vous Diamant.